Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center, who discusses major protests in Bolivia, demanding the nationalization of the country's energy resources, which led to the recent resignation of President Carlos Mesa. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Global Exchange, who looks at the British leaked Downing Street memo that many believe is a smoking gun, exposing the Bush administration's dishonest justification for launching the Iraq War. And Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who describes the political priorities discussed at the recent Take Back America conference, the largest gathering of progressives since the 2004 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Reuters reports that hunger is exploding in the war-ravaged Darfur province of Sudan, where violence has prevented farmers from planting crops. The United Nations World Food Program says 3.5 million people in Darfur are in need of food aid, more than half of the population. At the beginning of 2005, UN relief workers expected to provide food for 2.8 million people, but the number of hungry people has continued to rise beyond expectations. So far, 2 million have been forced to flee their homes due to violence from government-backed paramilitary units. Many are now living in camps for internally displaced persons. The International Committee for the Red Cross says it is now feeding over 320,000 people in refugee camps. The International Criminal Court has recently begun an investigation into war crimes committed in Darfur. Meanwhile, British rock star Bob Geldof is organizing a rally and a series of Live Aid concerts for July 2nd, just before the upcoming G8 summit in Scotland. The protest and concert is aimed at raising money and pressuring rich nations to cancel Africa's foreign debt and to double the level of aid to the region. President Bush has thus far rejected signing onto such an initiative promoted by his ally, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. For the first time in 20 years, Canada is debating building new nuclear power plants. Under pressure from the Kyoto Treaty on global warming and the rising cost of oil, Canada is looking for new energy sources that do not create greenhouse gases, and for some, nuclear power fits the bill. Yet, many energy experts say that nuclear energy is not reliable, as many nuclear plants have been shut down for years at a time while undergoing repairs. As S.A. Sharif, a solar energy expert at the University of Florida, told the Interpress service, energy from nuclear plants remains very expensive due to the limited global supply of uranium. On Capitol Hill, subsidies for new nuclear power plants have been tacked on to the McCain-Lieberman Climate Stewardship Act, which creates enforceable caps on carbon dioxide emissions. Many environmental groups object to funding new designs for nuclear plants and allocating $600 million to develop the new so-called clean coal technology. The aim of the nuclear subsidies is to win support for the McCain-Lieberman bill. Green lobbyists say it is a losing strategy. As Kevin Curtis of the National Environmental Trust told The Grist, an online environmental magazine, it is shifting the focus to industry handouts and away from the real solution, a strong, market-based program. Researchers from the Rocky Mountain Institute say improvements in energy efficiency are 6 times more effective in terms of cost, as is nuclear power, eliminating the need to build any new nuclear energy plants. Under the media radar screen, the Bush majority on the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, has taken away the right of some workers to organize. Last November, the NLRB, led by Robert Batista, a Detroit management lawyer, reversed a 2000 Labor Board decision that declared that workers in temporary agencies had a similar interest to full-time workers, which made it easier for unions to recruit temp and freelance workers in the growing tech industry. Now, temp workers need the permission of their contract agency and employer for the right to organize, something that would be rarely given. According to the American Prospect magazine, the temp sector is a $62 billion business, which is expected to grow 54% by 2012. As a rule, part-time workers make $4 an hour less than full-time workers and receive few health benefits. Yet the Bush-led NLRB is intent on rolling back the workers' right to organize. Batista, the Labor Board chair, is a vocal critic of card check union elections, where a majority of workers need to sign union cards to win recognition. In another setback, the Labor Board has also stripped graduate assistants at private colleges from being able to organize into a union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
after 2 weeks of militant protests across Bolivia demanding the nationalization of the Latin American country's energy resources, President Carlos Mesa offered his resignation in a televised address on June 6th. Mesa's resignation, the second time he's offered to step down in a year, would not take effect until accepted by Bolivia's Congress. Evo Morales, leader of Bolivia's leading opposition party, the Movement Towards Socialism, said that the resignation of President Mesa was not enough and called for the resignation of both the Senate President and Speaker of the House. New elections could be called by a caretaker government headed by the Chief Justice of Bolivia's Supreme Court. Tens of thousands of protesters made up of miners, labor activists, and Bolivia's poor majority indigenous population had converged on Bolivia's capital city of La Paz the night President Mesa resigned. The people of La Paz have experienced food and fuel shortages as a result of road blockades erected by demonstrators in recent weeks. Although 92% of Bolivians had supported a 2004 referendum directing the government to take back control of the nation's oil and gas industries, the International Monetary Fund had threatened to withhold aid if contracts with private energy companies were challenged. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who analyzes the roots of the nation's popular resistance to U.S.-backed neoliberal economic policies and their connection to the wider progressive movements across Latin America.
Bolivia is the poorest country in South America. It sits atop the second largest gas and oil reserves in all of South America. And Bolivians are very concerned that those resources be developed in a way that average Bolivians are going to see the benefits. 10 years ago, the gas resources were privatized. The benefits go to foreign corporations like British Petroleum and others. And so there's this huge movement demanding that the oil and gas be taken over again by the government the way it used to be. The government doesn't want to do that. It's under enormous pressure from the International Monetary Fund, from companies like British Petroleum and others to leave the oil and gas in their hands. And so right now, the capital of La Paz is shut down virtually entirely by tens of thousands of protesters who've come down from the indigenous areas of the highlands above the capital. Here in Cochabamba, where I live and work, the center of the city has been shut down almost every day for the last week. There's no automobile or bus traffic in or out of the city. We're closed down.
Maybe you could speak to a little bit of the history that has brought Bolivia to this point in time.
Yeah, a little context, just because I don't think most people think of Bolivia very often, except for llamas and ladies in big skirts and bowler hats. Bolivia, first of all, it's a beautiful country. It's highlands, it's jungles, it's valleys. It's got the most indigenous population in the entire Western Hemisphere. That said, Bolivia has, for the last 20 years, been the primary lab rat in Latin America for a whole set of economic policies imposed on it from abroad. I mean, if you think about the United States right now, up in the United States, you're having a big debate over what to do with Social Security. The president wants to privatize it. A lot of people are resisting that, I think, for good reason. One of the most fundamental decisions that a democracy makes is what's public and what's private. Education, health care, Social Security. Well, in Bolivia, that decision was completely taken out of the people's hands, taken really out of the government's hands, by the International Monetary Fund, who said, look, you're dependent on foreign aid. If you want foreign aid, if you want the assistance from the International Monetary Fund, here's the commandments. First, you have to privatize your natural resources, including oil and gas. Bolivia is resisting that. And so what you have actually in this country is two different social movements or big changes happening in the country at the same time. The first is a very broad popular resistance to these economic policies. And the second is, this is a country in which 60% of the population are indigenous. They are locked out of power in this country, and they are demanding that they become the stakeholders in the country and in its politics that they deserve to be. These two things have come together in the war over gas, because the indigenous populations especially, I think, are very sensitive to what it means to have natural resources stolen out from underneath their feet.
Jim Schultz, finally, I'd like to ask you this. How does the current crisis in Bolivia, how is it connected to progressive activism and a rejection of neoliberal economic policies pushed by Washington across Latin America?
Well, that is a very important question, and it's a good one to end on. I'm an American. I'm from California. And when you're from the United States at this time in history, it's easy to be a little depressed because it sure looks like the country is marching toward the right and toward a set of values that most of us don't agree with, and it's very hard to see how we're going to pull it back. Latin America is marching in the exact opposite direction. And, you know, there are a lot of reporters who come here and they all want to write the story about the new left in South America. And it's much more interesting than to call it the new left. This isn't the second coming of Che Guevara. What's happening here is not ideological. What's happening here is a very broad Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, a very broad reaction against the practical failure of a set of market fundamentalist economic policies imposed on this country from abroad and other countries as well. And, you know, I live here, and the poor who live in Latin America, they really don't have the luxury of ideology. What they want is practical solutions. Can they get water? Can their kids get educated? Can they get access to health care? Can they find a job? If these economic policies of privatization and the rest had worked, if they had delivered the goods, I think people in this continent would have embraced them. The fact that not only have they not embraced them, but in country after country these policies are being rejected is because they are a practical failure. They just don't work. They only make the lives of the poor more miserable. And that's what's happening here. And people take their politics very seriously in a place like Bolivia. They can't afford to just read about it in the newspaper or listen to it on the radio. They have to act. They have to be engaged because it affects their lives in a direct way. So I think what's happening in Bolivia is part of something that is happening all over this region, and it is really worth people in the United States, especially progressives, to try to understand what it really means.
That was Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center based in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Contact the center by calling their San Francisco office at area code 415-564-4767 or visit their website at www.democracyctr.org. Medea Benjamin is a longtime peace and social justice activist. In the 1980s, she co-founded Global Exchange, a nonprofit research, education, and action center that fosters people-to-people ties around the world. After the 9/11 terrorist attack, and in response to the Bush administration's color-coded terror threat alert system, she co-founded Code Pink, a creative movement of women and men who oppose what they brand the Bush agenda of never-ending war. Benjamin spoke last week in New Haven, Connecticut, as part of a tour promoting a new book she co-edited with fellow Co-Pink activist Jody Evans, titled Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism. In the following excerpt, Benjamin says that although exposure of lies and atrocities by the Bush administration has not yet triggered massive, vocal opposition to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, she is confident that a future disclosure will eventually provide that spark. One possible smoking gun she discusses is the so-called Downing Street Memo, first published in the British press on May 1st, that revealed the Bush administration had fixed its intelligence on Iraq around the policy of justifying the war. Benjamin also talks about the need to re-inspire some elements of the peace movement to realize that staying the course in Iraq just because U.S. troops are already there is not the way to peace.
Now, this kind of immorality is so directly coming from the White House and is not being discussed through the corporate media and is not trickling down to the discussion among people themselves. But we will be, and we don't know, again, what the spark will be. But there is a new document out there that should be the spark, and that is the Downing Street memo that just came to light recently, showed that back in July 2002, the British intelligence meeting with the Bush administration and hearing that the Bush administration was determined to go in and invade Iraq no matter what, and that even though the intelligence did not justify the invasion, in fact, they said there was more of a likelihood of weapons of mass destruction in North Korea and Iran and Libya than there was in Iraq. But they would, quote, fix the intelligence to justify an invasion. Now, that should set off the alarm bells all over the United States. Okay, now here we have it, the smoking gun coming directly from the intelligence services in England. But that has not sparked it either. And I say that we use that document, that we don't let that one go so quickly, that we start circulating that document. We raise money and put it in the papers. It's a short memo. But when you read the memo, I think a lot of people would say, wow, they really fixed the intelligence. And we have a very good constitutional lawyer that has just, on the basis of this memo, written a 5-page document showing how this memo is proof that George Bush conspired to deceive the U.S. Congress and the American people about the reasons for going to war. Now, in case you don't know what that means high crimes and misdemeanors. And in case you don't know what that means impeachment. Now, yes. I'm sure many of you are saying, oh yeah, nice thought, impeachment in a Republican Congress. Well, that's true. We're not going to get this Congress to impeach George Bush. But that shouldn't stop us from pushing the process forward. And we have one congressperson, John Conyers, who is serious about pushing that process forward. He wants 100,000 of us to sign up on his website, and he wants to get a letter of inquiry going within Congress. I say, let us support John Conyers. Let us push the process as far as we can, and let us force the press in this country to even begin the discussion. Now, there is another discussion that has to begin in this country, and that is about withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. It is absolutely absurd that that discussion isn't even happening in this country, and that a month ago, when we had another vote for another $82 billion to continue this immoral, unjust war, we couldn't even get one senator in this country to vote against that and could only get 44 members of Congress. That is absolutely astounding, and that is a reflection on us, the people. Because we poured out our heart and soul to try to stop this war, we weren't able to do it. We poured out our heart and soul to try to stop George Bush from having another 4 years in the White House, we weren't able to do it, and then we got tired. We got tired, we got disillusioned, we got disempowered, we got cynical, and meanwhile the war is raging. And meanwhile our Congress people feel that they are off the hook, even many of the progressive ones. And so part of my reason going around on this book tour is to re-enthuse people who were with us in the beginning of saying no to the war and are now either disillusioned or many of them are genuinely confused. How many of you have a little voice in your head that says to you every once in a while, now that we're there, maybe it would be wrong to leave Iraq, maybe we should stay there and, quote, try to fix it? If you don't have it, you know a lot of people who have that voice. And these are good, genuine people coming from a very good place. And it even includes people like Howard Dean, who at a recent meeting of the ACLU said, I was against the war to begin with, but now that we are there. We have to convince people that that argument doesn't make any sense because there is no way we can, quote, fix things in Iraq. I have been there myself 5 times. I've seen every time I've gone there things getting worse and worse and worse. And I'm absolutely convinced that they will not get better as long as the U.S. remains. That we don't know what will happen if the U.S. troops withdraw, but we know what will happen if they stay. And that is the violence will not stop and will only increase.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-editor of a new book, Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism, published by Inner Ocean Publishing. For more information about Code Pink, call area code 310-827-4320 or visit their website at www.codepinkforpeace.org. Since suffering significant losses in the 2004 presidential election, progressive activists have been assessing their strengths and weaknesses and reconsidering strategies needed to build a movement that can effectively promote peace and social justice in the national debate and at the ballot box. Over 2,000 progressive political activists, academics, and commentators recently gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back America conference, sponsored by the Campaign for America's Future. The conference, convened in early June, featured dozens of issue workshops and speeches from the likes of Democratic Party Chair Howard Dean, National Organization for Women President Kim Gandy, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, and Public Television's Bill Moyers. Organizers of the conference hoped the gathering would be a catalyst for building the infrastructure needed to ensure the voice of the progressive majority is heard. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran political organizer Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. He talks about the political priorities discussed at the Take Back America conference, the largest gathering of progressives since the 2004 presidential election.
It was an exciting conference. We had about 2,000 people come through. They were filled with high energy. And what became clear was that progressives kind of came out of that election last fall not discouraged, but emboldened, and people are really making things happen at all levels of the country. And so that was pretty exciting to see. We had sessions on foreign policy, on what an economics is that works for working people, a big challenge to the Bush agenda, obviously. Laid out initiatives that are working at both the federal and the, more importantly, the state and local level and moving forward. Look through the kitchen table issues that are of basic concern to Americans and which the Bush administration is really ignoring, and sort of went through political strategies of various sorts. So it was a terrific 3 days, and so there was a kind of sense of the beginnings of an alternative movement that had some real legs.
What was the most important thing that you think came out of the discussions held at this conference in terms of just ideas and strategies, coalition building, thinking about the 2006 election, which I think is critical in most people's view, even, of course, the Republicans who want to maintain power and others who want to break their iron grip on power in Washington? Anything come to mind as far as just important discussions and ideas that were hatched at the conference?
Well, I think you saw for the first time, there's been real silence on progressives around the war in recent months, partly, I think, because of the election in November when everyone unified to try to take out Bush, partly because of the election in Iraq in January, which bought the president some time. And I think at this conference you saw the beginnings of a crystallizing position about setting a date to get the troops out and the beginnings of a movement to make that happen. And I think you'll see that burst into the public this fall. We did another major set of workshops and analysis of the Walmart economy and Walmart specifically. Robert Greenwald announced that he's doing a big film on Walmart, and as part of that is linking with workers and consumer groups and feminist groups and church groups and a whole range of communities about the damage Walmart is doing to this economy. And I think you're going to see the beginnings of a multi-level campaign to expose the choices involved in the Walmart economy and the choices involved specifically with this viciously anti-union employer named Walmart, which is, of course, America's largest employer. Then we did the kind of defining fights that are ongoing right now, Social Security and the fight over the packing of the courts, and laid out the next steps in those two critical campaigns. And so I think those were the big issues that, in terms of campaigning and coalition building, that people looked at.
Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg, I believe, announced some interesting polling results about the national mood, national politics, and the possible future results of some elections around some key issues. What can you tell us about Stan Greenberg's poll there?
Yeah, the poll reflected what other polls are showing, which is Bush's popularity is sinking, that of the Republicans in Congress way down. The public strongly believes we're on the wrong track. They want a significantly different direction than that posed by the president. They have turned against his handling of Iraq, with the vast majority thinking just not worth the cost. The same with his economic program, and the same with his Social Security plan, which is now reached sort of rock bottom in terms of its acceptability. This is finally starting to have effect on Republicans in this kind of generic race against Democrats, where they're starting to sink. But more importantly, I think in the poll, what we explored was kind of people's kind of fundamental attitudes about the conservative kind of agenda and ideology. And what we found was, in large numbers, Americans prefer an activist government than a government that gets out of the way and lets companies compete. They want regulation of corporations. They want regulation of trade and a government that stands up for America and the trading system. They are looking for investment in education and healthcare, not more tax cuts. It was a rather striking across-the-board rejection of the conservative philosophy of smaller government, lower taxes, less regulation, and the kind of sense that people are connecting the failures of this economy, which simply isn't working for working people, with those big conservative themes. And so that's a big opportunity for progressives, not simply to perhaps do better in the election next fall than people suspect, but in terms of really going on the offensive about defending an activist government and about the need to change our priorities and to make the investments we need to make this economy work again.
That was Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.